Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, July 17, 2019, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Zeska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. My guest today is the writer I want to be when I grow up, the great and stupendous Charlie Pierce from Esquire, NPR Radio, and of course, the Stephanie Miller Show, where he engages in awkward phone sex with Jody Hamilton every week. Today, we're going to talk about Never Trumpers, the impact of social media on the political debate, Charlie's approach to writing and covering the Trump crisis, as well as a word or two about Star Trek, of course. Charlie's various links are available in the description below. Meanwhile, if you like what you hear, please support this show by subscribing to our bonus content on our Patreon page. That's BobZeskaShow.com. Okay, here we go at long last with my journalism hero, Charlie Pierce.
Here I am, yes, on my sofa.
Ah, it's so great to hear from you, my friend.
Hi, Bubba, what's going on? Is this the Sexy Liberal Network podcast?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
It's excellent.
My big Wednesday show, and I think your debut on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network.
It is, actually. I have not done any of the other Sexy Liberal podcasts yet. I was in L.A., but I wasn't there for the right day for the happy hour, so.
There's my one-man round of applause. Thank you so much.
And there we go.
And you know what? I'm so disappointed because I had to interrupt your latest debate with Tom Nichols on Twitter.
It's round and round we go at this point. Apparently people find it entertaining and informative. So what the fuck?
Yeah, you know what? Someone on Twitter yesterday suggested some sort of podcast with the two of you, and
I'm not gonna argue for a living with somebody. No, I already turned that down from ESPN.
Well, I'm thinking maybe a one-off. Maybe I get you back. Maybe I get Tom Nichols, and I can just moderate this as a one-hour special.
Well, I don't know. Let's do this first, though.
So what's your...
Have we started already, by the way? I don't even know.
We are absolutely underway. We're underway now.
Oh, okay,
now,
excellent. So, all right. I didn't hear a beep or theme music or anything, so...
We don't need any of that crap, Charlie.
It's kind of a bare bones thing going here.
So we're talking about Tom Nichols. Let me ask you about Tom Nichols. I get the sense that... Despite his former Republican affiliation, he's not a completely unreasonable guy. He's willing to bend on some things he might have resisted a few years ago. What's your readout on Tom?
Tom's a smart guy. Tom's a professor at the Naval War College. He's a Massachusetts guy, Western man. He's from that area of Massachusetts that we who grew up in Worcester call out by New York. I don't know Tom. I've never been in the same room with him. He's one of those Twitter guys.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying the back and forth. Other people seem to be doing it, and I think there's an interesting divide now, though.
Yeah.
The Never Trump Republicans were very useful. Mm. For the first 3 years.
Yeah.
But now the Democrats have to run for president again, and some of their advice isn't very useful.
Thank you. Yes, you're exactly right.
You know, I mean, they're valuable allies in the fight against the incumbent president.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily valuable allies in replacing him. I think we got to be very careful about that. And we have to be very careful not to, if the Democrat is fortunate enough to win in 2020, we have to be very careful and not let the Republicans do to Donald Trump what they did to George W. Bush.
That's right.
Which was basically dump the whole thing down the memory hole and pretend it never happened. Donald Trump should be a reason for the Republican Party to tear itself down to the ground and rebuild itself.
Exactly right. And the hope is, I mean, my hope for that 3 years that you talked about when the Never Trumpers were useful, my hope was that we could somehow form some kind of coalition, some sort of working group to come up with a series of things that close that giant Trump-shaped hole in the wall that he's created, and that we make sure that not another Trump, you know, Trump 2.0 comes sashaying through that hole. And I thought, you know what, look, if we can find common cause with these guys, and there is that big common cause, which is getting rid of Donald Trump, fixing all the things that he's broken, maybe that can work. But now I see exactly what you're talking about, because we're in this election cycle now, and it seems like the Never Trump approach is, Jesus, you guys are a bunch of feckless losers. You better step aside and let us take over here.
And drop all these crazy ideas that are coincidentally very popular in the country at large.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, make sure you don't disturb the guys, you know, eating their third plate of Scrapple in the diner.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I was very intrigued today by that. There's a Reuters poll that came out today on Wednesday, which said that Donald Trump had ticked up a couple of points in his approval rating with Republicans since going off on his racist, manic episode over the weekend.
Right.
But it went up 2 points to 72%.
Mm-hmm.
If his approval rating is 72% with Republicans in the 2020 election, he's going to get crushed.
Yeah, I thought that was horrible news for him, and of course, good news for the rest of us. Right now, I'm taking a look at some of those head-to-head polls and going, you know what? I'm not a fan of Joe Biden, but good Lord, those numbers are intriguing.
I think in the discussion is, and because it's so early, you could say anything. The discussion is always premised on it being a close election.
Yeah.
Nobody is factoring in the possibility that Donald Trump will take the Republicans down to a historic defeat.
Yeah.
Which is easily as likely as his being reelected at this point. Now, that situation will develop as we go along. But, you know, right now, as I said, if his approval rating among Republicans is 72%, he's in desperate trouble.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because he needs that in no lower than the mid-80s.
Yeah, yeah. On top of the fact that he's only at 44% among voters in general, and you combine those two things together, and it's kind of bad news for him. Although, listening to Never Trumpers, you think that he's about to just steamroll over the entire nation. In fact, Charlie Sykes wrote a piece for The Bulwark yesterday in which he was he was invoking George McGovern. He says, okay, you guys nominated another McGovern.
I read that. I don't know what Charlie was doing in 1972, but he misunderstands that election completely. nobody was overconfident about beating Nixon.
Right.
I mean, in the spring of 1972, Nixon came back from China. His approval rating was over 70.
Yep.
I don't know where they were so confident they nominated McGovern. They nominated McGovern because he won the primaries.
That's exactly right.
And then a lot of Democrats became never McGoverners.
Yep. Yep.
Especially including the AFL-CIO.
Yeah. And in fact, Hunter S. Thompson's book, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, I think contains a lot of that exact sentiment. Like, oh, God, you know, we're on board with McGovern, but was this the right guy? Was this the guy to do it?
Yeah. The very first, you know, Woodward and Bernstein Watergate stories came out in July and August of 1972 and had absolutely no impact on the election.
Right.
Because nobody wanted it. I mean, first of all, nobody except them wanted the story.
Mm.
And number two, nobody was willing to – McGovern tried right at the end to make an issue out of it, but nobody understood it at that point.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't think the Democrats were brimming with self-confidence in 1972.
Yeah, that's true. And you know what? Just going back to the –
I don't think anybody was brimming with self-confidence on anything in politics in 1972.
That's absolutely 100% true. And we saw it in so many different ways. And in fact, it was all part of a period of time in which no one knew which end was up politically. And that's, I think, why, you know, people attended to reelect Richard Nixon in that election in particular, because, well, for lack of anything else that we can kind of latch our brains around, why not this guy? We know him. We're familiar with him. So fine, Nixon again.
Yeah, there was some serious rat humping going on too. Let's not forget.
Yep,
we didn't find out about it till the following year, but there was a lot of manipulation. I mean, certainly low tech compared to what we're seeing now, but low tech manipulation in the early primaries, especially against Muskie, and a little bit against Humphrey, and you know that the line from the movie, it's a, you know, all the president's men, they wanted to run against McGovern. Look who they're running against.
Yep.
You know, I mean it worked.
Yeah.
They got caught, but it worked.
Why are you?
And I'm not saying that accounts for, you know, a 49 state landslide, but it's a factor.
Why are you making excuses for the Democrats, Charlie Pierce?
Why am I making excuses for the Democrats? Well, look, I'm not making excuses for the Democrats.
Of course
not. I think people are misdiagnosing the problem with the Democrats. The problem with the Democrats is George McGovern scared the hell out of them for 40 years, and they went along with some really bad policies.
Yeah, well, of course, what I'm referencing here is you fast forward another 40 years, and you get to voter suppression and all the rest of it, all these systemic hurdles that the Democrats have to jump over in order to win elections in the modern era.
And all of them are accounted for by the fact the Democratic Party let its mechanisms and its campaigns in the states go fallow.
That's right.
We wound up with lockstep Republican legislatures.
Right. Well, yeah, that is, to me, that's the unspoken crisis, I think, in Democratic politics, is at the state level, where I think we often focus most of our attention at the presidential level, maybe a little bit in the midterms and so on. But you know what? We got another election coming up this coming up November, where we've got a lot of state races, a lot of smaller campaigns going on that are, as far as I'm concerned, just as crucial as some of the national campaigns. And
sure, there's a couple of governor's races, right?
Yeah. Oh, God. Absolutely. It's odd to me, knowing the stakes that we've been told about from Never Trumpers. They say, okay, look, we want to get rid of this guy, but doing so while at the same time framing the Democrats as just being weak and feckless and ineffective and electorally challenged, like we can't find 270 electoral votes with a flashlight and GPS. That is not going to win over any support for this valuable advice that they're presenting to us.
No, and not only that, but I mean, the other thing is, you know, don't ally yourself with these crazy ideas. Don't run too fast or talk too loud. Don't startle the guys eating the scrapple in the diner. But the fact is that the next president cannot do what Barack Obama did, which is basically let these people off the hook.
That's right.
We can't look forward, not backward this time. I thought Elizabeth Warren was great at Netroots when she said, you know, when President Elizabeth Warren's not going to look the other way. She said she's going to take people to court.
Right.
Over the border stuff, and I think that's a commitment that's worth making. Not only that, but no, the Democrats aren't going to go along with, you know, supply side economics. They're not going to go, you know, they're not going to fall for the old Republican, you know, okie doke about how deficits don't count when there's a Republican president, but count immediately after a Democratic president's hand comes off the Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we've seen that scam run three times. It's not going to happen again. As long as they all understand that, then maybe there's some room for coalition building. But they're not going to turn the Democratic Party into Romney Republicans.
If
they want to turn a party into Romney Republicans, let them do it to the Republicans.
You know, just going back to your debates with Tom Nichols and speaking of Twitter, you've only recently become active there. I mean, what's your take on that platform? It seems like you're really taking to it. At least that's the outside
view. I like it because it's fun. I don't take it seriously.
Mm.
And I recognize the potential, you know, as we do with every new, it's not a new thing, but everything, you know, I recognize its potential for evil.
Yeah.
And I try to stay away from its, you know, from its incantations to the devil.
Mm.
But otherwise, it's fun, and I met a lot of interesting people.
Yeah, well, you seem
you know, I mean,
You seem uniquely suited for it. I mean, it seems like that's really, as far as...
Well, I spent an awful lot of time in saloons, Bob, you know, in my youth, and...
You know...
That's pretty much what it is, you know? If you find a good saloon with people in it who like to argue and like to talk, you know, that's one of the great things about Ireland is that in very many of the saloons, especially in the backcountry, there's no TV.
Yeah.
There's no jukebox.
Yeah.
The only thing people can do is, like, you know, fight and get into, you know, argue and get into disputations and talk to each other and occasionally sing.
Yeah.
I look at it that way. I look at it as a very valuable news aggregator because I follow so many local newspapers and I see a lot of stories that I would otherwise miss.
I'm not breaking any news by saying that you've been doing this for quite some time now. And one of the things I've observed about the addition of social media to the political debate in this country is that I think it's emphasized the idea that a lot of people, or maybe it's actually manufactured the idea, I don't know which it is, maybe you can help me out with this, everyone wants to save face. And you really see that on Twitter, where you could literally spend days and days and days on an endless thread on Twitter, where once you get to the end of it, there's nothing really resolved. And I find that inability to admit when you're off base about something, or and I'm talking about you in general.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but the idea that everyone needs to save face desperately for fear of being embarrassed or pantsed or whatever you want to call
it. Owned! Yeah. Owned!
Exactly. Exactly.
Ben Shapiro destroys Lib on Twitter!
Yeah, I just wonder if that's damaging the debate. If that's, I mean, I know there's lots of things we have to worry about, but I think in terms of that, the impact of social media on all of the things that we've been documenting over the past, especially the past 3 years.
I think, you know, the social media contributes to the coarsening of the debate on social media. In terms of its effect on the general, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what the political debate is in the country right now.
Yeah.
I mean, we're still dealing with, like, half the country doesn't even bother to vote. And I don't know what the horrendous percentage is that, of people who can't identify their congressman or their state legislator. I mean, a lot of the activity on political social media, I attribute to a lack of activity in actual politics. It's easier to tweet than it is to knock on doors. I think as a... There's a serious amount, and I think that, you know, certainly voter suppression and its, you know, ancillary effects have contributed to a sense of apathy, to the sense that elections don't count anymore.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people aren't driven to social media, but they do find, you know, they have found an artificial space to participate in politics without actually participating in politics.
That's right. In fact, I remember Bill Maher once said about online polls signing, or not online polls, but online petitions, that it's the least you can do without doing nothing. And I feel like sometimes social media substitutes for actual political action sometimes, and it's not as effective, I don't think, as doing something that requires some shoe leather and some knocking on doors. You know what I mean?
No, I agree. I think it's, you know, I think there's also a piece in it, at least among younger political consultants, you know, that they're all taken by the continuing, you know, messianic view of the internet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which
right.
should have been dispelled by now, God knows, but isn't. And, you know, somehow, you know, and I think that the Clinton campaign was particularly guilty of this. Mm. You know, the magic of the internet and the magic of analytics will guarantee our victory, as opposed to, like, you know, going to Wisconsin one more time.
Yeah, right.
And I think over-reliance on data and over-reliance on analytics was a real flaw in the Clinton campaign. I think it was a bigger flaw than the candidate.
Yeah, that's right. And it's actually surprising because I thought the Obama team did a pretty good job in terms of using analytics and using data and micro-targeting precincts and so on based on that information.
But they also had a once-in-a-lifetime charismatic candidate.
That is true.
And a once-in-a-lifetime set of circumstances,
mm-hmm,
which was the abject failure of a Republican administration, plus the biggest economic collapse since, you know, the Great Depression.
Yeah.
But so and they did manage to achieve a mix of those factors.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, Secretary Clinton, let's be honest, she's not Barack Obama. We learned that in 2008.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
In terms of a campaigner. And, you know, that it's always hard. I mean, what was it? George H.W. Bush is, the only vice president to accede after a two-term president in like 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, that's a tough hill to climb anyway, plus the 25 years of slander that, you know, had been heaped on her head. And I think it sort of drove the people running her campaign, you know, into the data and into the analytics so far. They didn't see what was really happening around them.
Yes, I think that's a in fact, I would say that's among the top five things that ended up manifesting the results of that particular election. It just there were lots of systemic things that I believe that that Russia had a lot more to do with the outcome than I think a lot of people are willing to admit. And I'm not talking about necessarily.
I think the overwhelming impression I still have of the 2016 Clinton campaign is they were always getting caught with all their data and with all their analytics. They were always getting caught flat-footed by something.
Mm-hmm.
They got caught flat-footed by Bernie Sanders. Nobody saw that coming.
That's right.
And it was well underway by the time they were able to deal with it. Nobody saw Donald Trump coming.
Mm-hmm.
And he was well underway. And the Clintons never really found a way to deal with that. They were caught flat-footed by James Comey. They were caught flat-footed by they're always caught flat-footed by the New York Times. Neither Clinton has ever been able to understand why the New York Times hates them.
That's true.
You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense that it rocks their comfort zone. And ultimately, they were caught flat-footed by the involvement of the Russians.
No doubt. And you know what concerns me more than anything else right now is that I get the sense that Joe Biden's going down that same road. Getting caught flat-footed by this or that. I mean, he certainly was a deer in the headlights when Kamala Harris hit him the other day in that debate, where I thought, my God, knowing what his oppo research looks like, you'd think he'd be better prepared for that, especially because
the guy's been in the Senate, you know, since Daniel Webster, for God's sake. I mean, his oppo research must be transported by barge at this point.
He's got
to know that. I mean, that's job one in selling Joe Biden to the country is deal with all the stuff he's done before.
Absolutely. And you know what? There had already been articles in major publications written about Joe Biden's actions with busing in the mid-70s and the segregationists and all the rest of them. That had been well documented to that point. It seemed like, oh, shit. You know, to me, it's, yeah, he's got a race problem, but at the same time, from a political point of view, he has got a serious deer in the headlights problem as being the front runner. There's no reason, especially what you were saying about 2016, especially with 2016 as precedent, there's no reason why the presumptive nominee of his party should be this ineffective in responding to something that he should have been prepared for. You know, he just needs a better answer.
No question. And let's be honest. He hadn't really gotten hit on Anita Hill yet.
Oh, that's right.
That's coming down the pike.
Yeah.
And he hasn't yet gotten hit on the bankruptcy bill, which Elizabeth Warren, I guarantee you, has, you know, a folder as big as the Ritz on that bankruptcy bill because they fought about it before.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got to know that's coming.
And you know what? If it doesn't come, we need to do our best, Charlie, to make sure that it actually does. Because of all the Biden things, that's one of the things that really sticks with me, where I can't find any way to explain that away, especially knowing that it came down a matter of a few years before the Great Recession, which, quite honestly,
right. Especially,
you know, you listen to someone like Tom Hartman, you listen to even Bernie Sanders, for that matter, they were all predicting that recession years in advance. I mean, it wasn't like this was out of the blue and we all were shocked and surprised that the financial sector collapsed. I mean,
there's video of Elizabeth Warren talking about it in 2004.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean,
right.
And she tells a story about how she put it in front of her class, mm-hmm, one day in the early 2000s. What happens if these things happen? If, you know, pulling out the Jenga pieces from The Big Short, and all the class says, you got to sell, you got to fire people, you got to close division, you got to lay off. And then one tentative student in the back of the class puts up her hand, puts up his or her hand and says, no, I go out and I buy everything so that my collapse will take down everything else. And as she says, her class in one 45-minute session invented Too Big to Fail.
Yeah.
People absolutely knew it was coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Brixley Bourne knew it was coming. Elizabeth knew it was coming. As you said, Bernie and everybody else knew it was coming. They saw it happening.
Yep.
Certainly, I got to believe the people in the bank saw it was coming and just didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they could they thought they could get out before the critical Jenga piece got pulled out, and it didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. Are you leaning toward Senator Professor Warren like I am, or where are you? Right,
oh, yeah,
now
I mean, I am very conflicted because I knew her and her husband long before she ran for Senate, let alone president.
Yeah,
I'll tell you the story. I was at the Boston Globe magazine, and they tasked me to write a cover story in 2008 when everything was hitting the fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, okay, I'll do it, but you got to understand, I know nothing about economics. So they said, well, go on over to the news side and ask around and see if they know anybody you should talk to. And somebody gave me Simon Johnson, and I talked to him at MIT, and I tried to talk to Rubini, but he wasn't in the country at that point, I think. And finally, I ran into Mike Resendez, my old Boston Phoenix running buddy, the guy Mark Ruffalo played in the movie Spotlight, by the way.
Oh, yeah, great.
And he had just done a long series on collection agencies,
mm-hmm,
and their nasty tactics.
Yep.
And I said, who do you know that can explain this, whatever this is happening? You know, because I don't know about you, but for me, I woke up one morning and the world economy was collapsing. I didn't know it was coming. It just happened one day.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, one day, people in Washington were saying, well, you know, if we don't get this money by 8 o'clock, every business in America is going to go out of business.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we're all going to have red lines. It's going to last 50 years. So I went to Mike and I said, look, I don't understand this stuff. Who, you got anybody from your list of sources that I could? And he said, yeah. He said, there's this woman over at Harvard Law. Go over there, sit with her for an hour, you'll understand it. So I went over and I met the senator professor. And she turned out to be a big fan of an NPR show I do called Only a Game, a sports show.
Yeah.
So we talked about that for a while. And then I said, look, I don't know what this is. I mean, I don't know what's happening. The world is coming down around my ears, and I never heard the tremblers. And within 40 minutes, I understood the whole thing.
Wow.
She just sat there and said, she explained collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps and how that, you know, connected to home mortgages, how that connected to the credit freeze. And I walked out of there, and I already knew anything I needed to know for the piece.
Yeah.
And so I go, like I said, I go back with her for a while. I have an unavoidable conflict. I wrote a lot that she shouldn't run for president, and she's proving me wrong.
Yeah.
Win or lose, she's running a hell of a campaign.
What are the things you think she needs to overcome in order to win? I mean, just maybe the nomination and then the general.
Well, I think having a uterus is right up there.
That would be true. Yeah.
I don't think we want to minimize that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're going to come at her with the Native American thing, but I think that's played out.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it hasn't worked for anybody yet. It certainly didn't work for Scott Brown. I think they're probably going to come at her with the Harvard elitist, but that dispenses, you know, as soon as anybody spends 15 minutes with her in a room, they know she's not a Harvard elitist. I think that, you know, they might come at her as being too far left, and I think they'll get some help from certain Democratic quarters in the primary on that one. They'll certainly come after her on foreign policy. Because that's, I mean, let's face it, that's not her wheelhouse. That hasn't been what she's been doing.
Yeah.
So I think those, and of course, there'll be the usual, you know, slanderous nonsense. They'll find somebody, you know, that she gave a D to in her class who says she's a terrible professor and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and who knows what the Russians will come up with.
Oh, right, right. Well, that's,
I mean, once you've dispensed with, you know, empirical reality, it's a breeze.
Yeah, I mean, talk about something that no one saw coming. I mean, no one saw the Russian interference coming. And so that's one of the biggest things I think that's creating almost, Charlie, like a national nervous breakdown. I think it's obviously...
Well, that was the whole point of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent a long time wondering if the Trump victory wasn't some sort of beta test that got out of the lab. That they were going to try this stuff. They were going to try this stuff out and then really hit us with it in 2024.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, it was working.
Yeah.
Beyond their wildest dreams. So they just said, screw it, let's go. And all they were doing, all they really wanted to do was sow chaos. And sow this, you know, this kind of distrust that you're mentioning.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I certainly didn't think, I don't think even they thought he was going to win.
Oh, God, no. In fact, what the intent was, I mean, I think what we know right now, at least based on some of the intelligence, is that Vladimir Putin was just simply trying to weaken Hillary so that when she became president, that she would be more vulnerable than she would have been otherwise. And I think that was the intent. And then suddenly, wow, it worked beyond, I think, his wildest dreams, Putin's wildest dreams. I mean, are our elections becoming permanently the domain of foreign interference? I mean, should we? This is something we should expect from now on, that we should plan for.
Oh, it's definitely something we should plan for.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any question about that. And I have faith in our nerds. I think given sufficient inducement, I think our nerds can beat their nerds.
Yeah,
I mean, our nerds came up with this nonsense in the first place. I think it will be helpful if the national government were to pay a little bit more attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very big proponent of Jay Johnson's proposal to make voting systems part of the national infrastructure.
Yeah, I agree with that,
too. Which got hand-waved away. I certainly think that the biggest mistake Barack Obama made was going along with or being scared out of announcing this during the election by Mitch McConnell.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that was the last gasp of Barack Obama's admirable but ultimately failed attempt to reach across the aisle.
Yeah, sometimes you just have to throw caution to the wind, and Barack Obama was, well, he had a lot of caution. There was a lot of caution all throughout
the years.
You're
the president of the United States, and you know that Russians are screwing with the election.
Mm-hmm.
You tell the country. That's what you do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like Kennedy and the missiles in Cuba.
Right.
Once you're sure, tell the country. Show the country the evidence.
I mean, now that we know, I mean, now that everything is out, why do you think Nancy Pelosi is so hesitant to hold this guy accountable? Why is there such a feet dragging when it comes to impeachment?
I honestly think she thinks it's a political loser.
Yeah.
And she's not going to get moved off that. Hmm. I liked what happened yesterday. I like putting people on the record. I love putting people on the record.
Yeah.
In that sense. I think that was a big step. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
My instinct tells me that he's going to do his, it's all in my report and I have nothing further to say, and therefore let everybody down. But if they keep poking him the way they have, keep trying to devalue his entire public career.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those guys who, you don't want to get in a fight with because you're never really sure if he's going to know when the fight was over.
Right.
I mean, the guy didn't win a couple of silver stars in Vietnam by, shirking from a fight. I don't know. Maybe if the lunatics on the committees, poke him enough,
mm-hmm.
we might see something interesting happen.
Yeah. Yeah,
they're certainly scared of it. I mean, they're certainly, in the White House and outside, they're certainly nervous about his testifying.
I want to turn now to writing. And, I don't say this lightly. You, sir, are the writer I want to be when I grow up.
You're too kind.
Anyone who asks, that's how I feel. What's your approach to covering Trump and all of this madness as a journalist, as a writer, as an observer of the political scene? How do you digest this crap, Charlie?
Well, I don't think I digest it very well. My stomach's hurt ever since November of 2016.
Me too.
I try, as I've gone along, I've tried to do two things on the blog. One, as best I can, to avoid the shiny objects. Some of the shiny objects are very serious, and you can't really ignore them, as we discovered over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also tried to keep track of the very real damage that's being done below the surface of the government. The lack of staffing of positions, this insane effort now to move the government out of Washington and move, the Department of Agriculture in Kansas City and the, the Department of the Interior or the Bureau of Land Management to Colorado Springs, the incredible list of unqualified and only semi-qualified, larval Scalias into the federal bench.
Yeah.
This is all the stuff that's going to outlive Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
or outlive his administration.
Yeah.
And that's sort of been my lodestar. Like I said, what I said before, when I follow on Twitter, I follow all those local newspapers because that's where you get the information about, you know, what's going on in state legislatures, which is, you know, you have to follow the Republicans in the state legislatures. For that matter, you have to follow the Democrats in them too, because that's the farm team.
Yep.
You know, the people in the Congress now didn't come from nowhere. They didn't come from the air. They came from state, by and large, they came from state legislatures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you, if you know, the future Louis Gohmerts are down there somewhere.
It's terrifying.
And if you keep an eye on them, you can recognize them before they, you know, turn up on C-SPAN.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's a lot of what I try to do. I spent 8 years writing, you know, a sports column for a tabloid owned by Rupert Murdoch, the Boston Herald. So I learned after, you know, a long apprenticeship at the late, great Boston Phoenix, where I wrote long, I learned to be pithy writing the sports column. So, you know, I've got a couple of pitches still left in the repertoire on that. But basically, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to tell the truth in my eyeball.
Yeah.
You know, based on 40 years in the biz and I'm trying very hard to distinguish what's unprecedented from what has happened, and we just called it by a different name.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
To actually put all of this in context, not only in terms of what we've experienced, but where it's going into the future, I think is absolutely vital. And it's that context, I think, that not only provides a sense of panic in some cases, but also provides a sense of relief. And I think that's also important for us to experience. See also previous nervous breakdown remarks. Do you ever experience a sense of dread, as though the pendulum's not going to swing back?
I was just saying the other day, I was talking to somebody at Netroots Nation about this. I can't remember who it was.
Yeah.
But on the one area on which I feel a sense of looming dread is the climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I am coming to the belief that a democratic system of government cannot cope with what's coming.
Yeah.
There are too many choke points and the crisis is too big. And that scares the hell out of me. Because unless a democratic system of government prepares for what's coming, an authoritarian government will be the ones who make the tough calls on who lives and who dies and who lives where.
Well, especially
that scares the hell out of me.
Yeah. And you know what? Feeding that, I think, Charlie, this concept that democracy can't handle it. I get the sense that, and this is just through my own experience, I don't know if this is anecdotal to me or everyone's experiencing this at the same time, this phenomenon that every time I write about the climate crisis, every time I tweet about it, every time I, everything from a blog post to a thousand words on Salon, my response, crickets chirping. I think people are so terrified and overwhelmed by the degree of that crisis that it's almost like no one wants to look into that burning reactor core. You know what I mean?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the only people, as near as I can tell, in the federal government who are taking preparations for the climate crisis seriously is the military.
Yeah, NASA.
The Pentagon's got no place for climate deniers.
Mm-hmm.
They're fortifying naval bases. They're talking to the Dutch about how they do it. Now, all of this may not matter. That's a scary thing. Mm-hmm. But they're at least confronting the size of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrifying. And
to me, it's absolutely the one master crisis behind all the others.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind of a gold-plated healthcare system we devise. It's going to be overwhelmed by epidemic disease.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what kind of humane and structured immigration system we developed. It's going to be overwhelmed by mass migration.
Yeah.
People are going to go where the water is. The next world war is going to be fought over water. It's not going to be fought over oil.
Yep, that's 100% true. 100% true. In fact, people are preparing for that now. The guy behind, what was that movie a few years ago about the financial collapse? And the guy who saw that, played by Christian Bale in the movie, and the name of the movie
right, the drummer.
Yeah, exactly.
The drummer with ADHD.
Yeah.
Michael Burry.
There you go. That's it. That's
his
it.
His name, yeah.
And
that's what he's doing now, right? I mean, he's dedicating himself to shorting water.
Yeah, exactly. That, and he's preparing for that. And good Lord, he's going to make a fortune probably. But, you know, look.
Nobody's going to be alive. Nobody's going to be alive to cut him the check.
I mean, here's what I'm thinking about in my darkest hours. One, how do we as communicators turn that ship? How do we communicate to people in a way that gets them triggered into action? Likewise, you know, I also find myself contemplating the possibility that the remainder of my career is going to be documenting the collapse of it all.
I mean, I think it's a live possibility. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that 5 years ago. I think it's a live possibility that under the pressure of the climate crisis and our lack of response to it, that all the systems will collapse.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And
we're losing Louisiana by the yard.
Yeah.
You know, we're losing Alaska. The nation of Tuvalu isn't going to exist in 5 years. It's going to be underwater. We're losing entire countries.
And I keep projecting what we do now as a country onto what we will do in the future, say 10 years in the future. What we do in this country, more often than not, if you look at the healthcare system, for example, what we do is we target the symptoms. We rarely target the cause. Every pharmaceutical ad you see on MSNBC during the day is an ad for how we focus on the symptoms, not the cause. And my concern is that what we're going to do, the way we're going to tackle the climate crisis, instead of, you know, coming up with solutions to the root cause, instead we're going to be finding ways to build better seawalls and sand berms. You know what I mean? And that's terrifying to me.
Like, okay, you know, I tell people this story all the time. For the last book I wrote, I went to a place called Shishmaref in Alaska, which is a barrier island on the Chukchi Sea in the Arctic, and it's slowly being eaten away by the ocean because the ocean doesn't freeze as long. The permafrost is gone. And that's where typhoons go to die. So typhoons used to go up there and beat themselves to death on the Arctic sea ice, and you know that would be it. But now they go up there and they pull great chunks of this island back out with them because they're fighting, you know, they're fighting over an ocean that hasn't frozen. And on the beach at Shishmaref, on the shores of the Chukchi Sea, there are three previously failed seawalls that you can identify in a line.
Yeah.
You know, gradually moving their way back towards the town. And it's like seeing an archaeological dig where there are like seven, like Troy, where there are like seven cities in one place.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. And that's what, and you're right. I mean, every one of those seawalls was supposed to do the job and it didn't.
Yeah.
You know why? Because the ocean doesn't care who wins the debate.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. No matter what we come up with, no matter what system there is, life finds a way. Nature will find a way to bash right on through that as long as we're not conquering the root cause of all of this. But I mean, turning back to Trumpism for a second, do you think is this going to be a part of our politics for the foreseeable future? Is there a good chance that we successfully bottle this back up? I mean, what are the odds of one or the other?
That's going to be completely up to our friends, the Never Trumpers.
Yeah.
they're going to have to wring it out of their own party.
That's right.
And you know, I mean, I've said all along that what really terrifies me about this is the next guy's not going to be bad at it. The only thing that's partially saved us so far is the guy's an incompetent as well as an authoritarian.
Yeah. Yeah.
The next guy may not be incompetent.
Right. Right.
And we got to be ready for him. And the Republicans have to be ready for him because 9 times out of 10 he's going to come from that side of the aisle.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the Never Trumpers control a considerable number of voters? I mean, what's the percentage of the voting population that the Never Trumpers actually influence?
I don't think they influence any voters. I think they influence influencers.
I see. Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
I think you're talking about independents, and I don't know how in the hell anybody can be an independent at this point, but that's neither here nor there. I don't think there are that many. I think most people who tell pollsters they're independents are probably lying.
Yeah.
Because they think it makes them look smarter and more involved.
Right.
I honestly don't know. I mean, I think, as I said before, I think if his approval rating among Republicans is 72%, he's going to go down to a crashing defeat.
Yeah. Well, good Lord, I hope so. You know, going back to your writing here, one of the most beautifully written political essays I've ever read by anyone living or dead was your thing in Esquire last October about Christine Blasey Ford and the Kavanaugh debacle. If those of you listening today want to check it out, it's titled "This Vicious Buffoon is a Vessel for All the Worst Elements of the American Condition." You, sir, have a gift for balancing your writing between serious analysis, jokes, and wordplay. I think it's one of the best things that you do as a writer is drawing the balance between those three plates to spin. And of course, you know, stirring rhetoric that, I mean, in particular, that piece was just like poetry. I mean, how do you even begin?
Well, you had to have been, I think you had to have been in the room to really, you know.
Well, set the scene. How do you begin to construct a piece like that one?
Well, something I learned, as I said, writing a sports column at the Boston Herald, you give it the best effort you can in the time you have to do it.
Yeah.
Which on the internet is, of course, you know, an hour and a half ago.
Sure, yeah.
And then,
yeah.
And then you know, if you give it the best you can for in that period of time, and then you go do it, you know, you suck it up and go get them tomorrow, as the old baseball manager used to say. That was really like kicked off a lot of synapses, though, because it was such an incredible spectacle.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the guy's asking Amy Klobuchar if she gets blackout drunk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of things that I didn't expect to be covering in my life, but that was certainly one of them.
It amazes me how you just have this, it seems effortless to me that you're able to balance the seriousness with the jokes in a very, very effective way. And it's not easy to do. It really isn't, especially when you've got an audience that I think there are a lot of people who are really suffering emotionally with what's going on right now. And it came to one of many heads during the Blasey Ford situation and the Kavanaugh hearings. And you were able to crystallize all of that with that same balancing act between those things where you've got this prose and then you've got jokes and you're able to draw them together in a way that doesn't turn people off. It actually attracts, you know, just the right eyeballs to those pieces. It's a remarkable thing to look at. I mean, do you ever catch yourself going too serious or too silly with a piece and then suddenly having to pull back from it? You're like, oh, wait a minute. Now this is too silly for the subject matter. Or this is too serious for the subject matter. Do you ever find yourself in that place?
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm sure I make, you know, at this point, I make those kind of calls at almost a subliminal level.
Yeah.
Generally, if a piece is going to be lighthearted and I hope funny, I know that from the start.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's only so, I mean, I just did one not long before you called about this guy. This Representative Kelly, who says he's a person of color because he's white and Anglo-Saxon. First of all, if he's Kelly, he's not an Anglo-Saxon.
Jesus,
he's insulting.
God.
He's insulting his ancestors by saying so.
Yeah.
And second of all, white is not a color, as we all learned in second grade.
It's the absence,
of color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. Oh, God damn it. And see, that's just the thing.
Who votes for these guys?
I don't know how they can continue to get away with just rank nincompoopery like this. I mean, if it's not anything the president says, it's one of these guys blurting just something inexcusably dumb. You just can't, no matter what, you know, we hear Chuck Todd say on cable news, you just can't draw an equivalent with any other political faction in this country. The shit that we see from the Republican Party, especially now, is just inexcusable, and yet they keep getting away with it, don't they?
Oh, yeah. There's absolutely no question, because there's an audience for it, and the audience has been carefully built up over the past 40 years.
Well, before we let you go, Charlie, what do you do for fun? What do you do to unwind? What would you recommend to the rest of us who are, you know, we've got our faces pressed up against our computer screens watching this horror show on a daily basis? How do you decompress?
I walk. I read a lot for fun. I have to get back. I used to fence. I got to get back. I hurt my knee. So I got to get back to that. Live your life. You know, I mean, it's hard to turn it off. I understand that.
Yeah.
And I have a real trouble doing it myself, but you know, just try to get out in the world. I mean, one of the things I do every day is I take the bus to the place where I write, and I like being on the bus.
Wow.
You know, I like being on the bus with other people going to work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's my only advice, and I'm certainly not anybody's life coach.
Do you go? Do you go to like a public place to write, or is there like a?
Well, now that it's hot, I go to the Watertown Library in Massachusetts.
Oh, how about that? Oh, that's great.
Big old oak reading room. Makes me feel like a, you know, a scholar of some sort.
You bring a cigar and some brandy. Seems to be as if.
No food and only bottled drinks.
You don't wear an ascot or something to a place like that.
No.
Well, you know, my friend, it was a pleasure finally getting to talk to you, and I swear to God.
Yeah, it's great to be on the old network.
I'm going to put it together. I'm going to get Tom Nichols, and we're going to do a one-off where I'm just going to get you guys to beat each other to death with shovels.
Oh, you're a miserable human being. What can I tell you?
It'll be like that Star Trek episode. What is it, A Mock Time?
I'm deep in the plaque tau of the blood fever. All right. Except that's all about like mating and stuff, and I don't want to even think about that in relation to Tom.
Yeah, and you're a Civil War guy, aren't you too?
A bit of one, yeah. Okay. Not a great one, but you know, I know my friend Bob Bateman in Washington, who also writes for the blog from time to time. He's my military historian.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah, I'll have to take you around Gettysburg one of these days. I am just.
I love it. I love it. Bob does it like a 2-day tour of it, which. I am told is really wonderful.
Yeah, you know, if you ever get down there and you get a chance to go around with a licensed battlefield guide, ask them to do Longstreet's Countermarch. That's just my little bit of a... There's no more fascinating a tour of the Gettysburg battlefield than finding out how Longstreet got his entire division over to Devil's Den and Little Round Top. An incredible story to actually experience firsthand on the same roads. It's an incredible thing. My friend...
Well, I mean, Longstreet was one of the true Reconstructionists.
That's absolutely
true. Became
a
Republican, became ambassador for Turkey, and all of his former colleagues hated him.
Yeah.
Plus, he was right about Gettysburg.
He was absolutely 100% right about Gettysburg. But don't say that in the South.
Okay.
All right, my friend. It was great talking to you. And
Thanks, Bobby.
We'll see you on Twitter. Take care.
I hope so. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, this is Randy Rhodes, host of the Randy Rhodes After Hours podcast. If you love this episode, you're going to love the whole show. Every week we talk about everything that matters to you, from our future as a democracy to our existence on this here planet. Find it all at sexyliberal.com on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and anywhere and everywhere you get your podcasts.